The Tom Woods Show, episode 1870.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Saifedean Ammous is back with us on the show. He is the author of The Bitcoin Standard, The Decentralized Alternative to Central Banking. He's super knowledgeable about Bitcoin. He's also an excellent Austrian school economist. And I thought, especially given all the interest in Bitcoin over the past several months and into the end of 2020, it might be a good time to bring him back and ask some more questions and talk about what's going on. So I'm delighted to welcome him back. Saif, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, we got plenty to talk about here. I haven't talked about Bitcoin in a long time. In fact, I think the last time I talked about it was with you, and that seems like it's been rather a long time. I mean, there's been a pandemic in between the last time we talked and now. And I have to say, by the way, just as a matter a little bit off topic, that you've been excellent on that too. You've been just as good on that as you are on money. So, you know, kudos. Congratulations. Well, I've done so many episodes on that, though. If I start down that road, it's going to be another one, and we're going to talk about Bitcoin today, I've told everybody. So I always feel like, especially because I have a lot of new listeners because they started following me because of the virus coverage, and they stayed for the Austrian economics, you know, they stayed for all the other stuff. So I do feel like it is necessary to begin with the standard question that you just get asked all the time, which is, can you just try and give us the dumb guy explanation of what Bitcoin is before I start asking your questions about it?
Basically, Bitcoin is just another form of money that you can add to all the currencies that exist in the world right now, but it works differently under the hood. That's, I guess, the simplest way to think about it. You know, so there's pounds and euros and yens and dollars, and now there's Bitcoin as well. And it's another currency out there, but it's different from all the other ones in that it is not issued by a central bank. It's issued by its own users on the internet, and it has a protocol with fixed parameters that it has stuck to for 12 years. And the most interesting thing about it is that it has a fixed supply of 21 million and a fixed inflation schedule, and nobody has found a way of getting it to divert from that schedule in the 12 years in which it has operated so far.
All right, excellent. Boy, that's actually very good. Now, I want to, first of all, say, I don't know if there's a problem with mentioning the name of the show. So let's just say there was recently a very, 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 very well-known public figure and podcaster who inquired with the general public about somebody from the Austrian school who should come onto his program. And you were the overwhelming choice. And a lot of people who follow me were, maybe they don't follow me quite closely enough, doggone it, but they who followed me, they were not familiar with you. And they thought, well, I hope he's going to represent us well. And so I jumped in and said, well, let me tell you something. Saif is, not only is he great on Bitcoin, but what you don't probably know is that he's great on Austrian economics and he's great on money. I said, he's as hardcore Rothbardian on money as any of the best people we have. So you should be thrilled that he will be representing us. So piggybacking on that, is there something about Bitcoin that you think should be especially attractive, not just to libertarians or people for political reasons, but for economic reasons, people who belong to the so-called Austrian school?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Bitcoin and Austrians is a natural fit. And a lot of people have come to learn Austrian economics because of Bitcoin. First, you know, on an intellectual level, Bitcoin is the first money that does what Rothbard and Mises say money can do, which is have a fixed supply and still not restrict the growth of the economy. So the Bitcoin economy has grown roughly at around 200% a year in the last 10 years. And the supply of Bitcoin has grown at a far lower rate. It's growing at around 2% per year now, a little less than 2. So we have direct empirical test of the Keynesian contention that you need the money supply to grow in order for the economy to grow, and the Austrian contention that you don't. And it seems to be going in the Austrians' favor so far. So I think once you see that, it's really only the Austrians who say that the quantity of money doesn't matter and you could actually have theoretically a fixed supply money. Only they could get it, while all other economic schools have basically been stuck at saying this is just tulips, this is tulips, this is a bubble, this is going to burst. They've been saying this since Bitcoin was under $1, and they're still saying it at $60,000. So I think the intellectual aspect of it is the first one. But then, of course, the second and the more political one, which is more relevant for libertarians as well as Austrian economists, is the fact that it is money that works without the state. It's another sort of direct empirical test of the claim of the state theory of money, that you need the government in order to make money work, that money is a unique market good that can't be provided on the market. Well, we have Bitcoin working currently worth $1 trillion, existing all over the world without any regulatory authority controlling it and without needing the permission of any government to operate. So it's not the invention of the state and it's not the invention of a central bank. And then, of course, the political implication of this is that if this thing continues to grow, then you have a free market alternative to central banks. So this is a kind of actionable political activism, individual, one person at a time, ending the Fed by simply upgrading to a better way of doing money, which is just a much more advanced way of doing money because it depends on computers and machines and mining equipment that is highly sophisticated and uses energy instead of having to rely on politics and politicians and economists and wars and geopolitical contentions between nation states in order to make a monetary system work. So this is just puts all of that into just a system for proof built on energy.
Now, you said that you were talking about Austrians and that, you know, there's a natural affinity here. But as we know, there are some people who are at least sympathetic with the Austrian school. There's no need to mention names here. I think we know who we're talking about. But there are some people who are not particularly enthusiastic about Bitcoin and who do say it's a bubble, and they say that it has a natural, let's say, inherent, quote-unquote, value of zero, and that that's where it will ultimately trend. You know, again, it's another kind of question. I kind of pride myself on the show in not asking the same questions that the guest has answered a million times before. But frankly, this is a question a lot of listeners are curious about. How are you able to look at this issue and say definitively, there is no bubble here? There's something real happening.
Well, I mean, you know, definitively, ultimately, it's a question of market judgment. It's market calculation and entrepreneurial judgment to make what you want. And I think the thing about Bitcoin is that the more that people study it, if you look at skeptics, generally, they're not people who have spent a lot of time trying to figure out how it works under the hood. But if you do, you know, once you start realizing how it works, you start seeing that, well, you know, looking under the hood of this car, I think it's okay for me to get into this car. So the more people study Bitcoin generally, the more they realize how safe it is, how reliable it is, how effectively it does one small thing, which is just update a record of transactions with 2,000 to 3,000 transactions every 10 minutes. And it uses an enormous amount of processing power and computing power and a large network of many computers all over the world just to ensure that this thing is done accurately. So it, in a sense, it's kind of overkill to make sure that this thing can't be tampered with. And it seems to be working. I mean, it is working. So ultimately, the question is, yeah, you can be skeptical about it. But at some point, you need to understand that the skepticism has a cost. You know, you can be skeptical about the fact that engines work, that sanitation works, or that cars work. But, you know, that carries a massive cost. If everybody around you is using those things and you aren't, they're going to have a much better life, much better standard of living. And Bitcoin is like that. It's a form of money. And obviously, you know, all forms of money have their, you know, the ways in which they can fail. They can be stolen. They can be inflated away. Bitcoin protects you against the inflation risk. It still includes other risks, of course. It's not like a panacea. You know, you could lose your Bitcoin. If you don't know what you're doing, you could get hacked. But the system itself, essentially, the more you study it, the more you realize how reliable and dependable it is. And in fact, you realize that it's far more dependable than the central bank run alternatives. And so after a while, you start realizing the really risky thing to do is not to have Bitcoin, because then you're betting on something that's very unreliable with a terrible track record, which is central bank money. And effectively, you're short Bitcoin. You're betting against the growth of this very advanced new upstart, which has been part of a very powerful trend of about 200% a year in 10 years. So you're betting that something is going to derail this trend, this very powerful trend that has been happening. And I think when you start thinking of it this way, it becomes more and more rational to start taking in a small position in it. And, you know, eventually it basically grows on you, because it grows as a part of your portfolio, and then it just continues to be there. I think you just need to follow it for a while and learn how it works and see how it just unfailingly delivers approximately every 10 minutes a new block, and how it's always liquid, it's always trading all over the world. And yeah, you see that it's a more advanced, more reliable form of doing the things that central bank money allows us to do.
Several years ago, Bitcoin very nearly, but not quite, hit $20,000, then fell back a bit. And then in March of 2020, I think it was then, it hit a real low, but, you know, not in terms of overall. I was still way, way up overall. But now, of course, especially into 2021, there's just been an explosion. Of course, there are all these people who said, well, we hope you sold when it was nearly 20,000. You're never going to see that again. And as you say, here we are at right around 60. What accounts for that dramatic rise?
Yeah, it's what we like to call the unique underlying technology behind Bitcoin, and that is number go up technology. Bitcoin is just built so that over time, the things that you can exchange, the number of things that you can exchange with Bitcoin goes up. The number of dollars, the number of apples, oranges, cars, houses, it just gets more of everything over time. I think, you know, the way that I explain it in my book, it's just, it's a result of the fact that Bitcoin's supply is completely inelastic to demand. It's the first good that we have that, well, the first liquid good for whom supply is completely irresponsive to demand. If there are 7 people using Bitcoin all over the world, or if there are 7 billion people using Bitcoin all over the world today, we're still going to be getting 900 Bitcoins produced today. That's what's going to happen regardless of how many people use it. So it's a completely unique economic good in that regard. There's nothing quite like it. We're constantly producing more of it, but we're only producing according to a set schedule, completely irresponsive to the demand, completely separate from demand. The difficulty adjustment behind Bitcoin, which I really recommend looking into, it's kind of the secret sauce that holds Bitcoin together. It continuously adjusts the difficulty of mining to make it harder to mine Bitcoin, to ensure that as more people get into the network, we don't get more Bitcoin. We simply have more secure mining and harder mining. And so that makes the network more secure. So every time there's an increase in demand for Bitcoin, there's no way to make more Bitcoin. Instead, more people mine the network becomes bigger, the amount of security behind it becomes bigger. And that encourages people to view the network as being more secure, which leads to more store of value demand, which leads to the price rising again. So it's just this constant snowball of price rises that happens because there's no demand. There's no mechanism for the supply to increase to meet the increasing demand. And so we're still at a point where all Bitcoin is, even with all of this rise, is still $1 trillion. I mean, that's an enormous amount to think about it. If you had told me 10 years ago that Bitcoin would be worth $1 trillion today, I would have thought that's insane. But here we are. But still, it's about 1% or so of all of the money all over the world, depending on how you calculate it, 1 or 2%, depending on which measure of money you use. So still got a long way to go. But, you know, the only way for it to grow is not through making more Bitcoin, but through raising the price of the Bitcoin and dividing them among people. So that's what I call number go up technology.
Well, I think one of the criticisms that we've heard, and maybe this is one of the things that, let's just say, Peter Schiff would say, is that right now, most people, I'm not even sure if this is true, by the way, but this is what I've heard. Most people buy Bitcoin not because they want to make transactions with it, but because they think it's going to keep going up and they figure it's nice to have an appreciating asset in my portfolio. Whereas the way people were thinking about Bitcoin originally when I first got into it and people were excitedly telling me about it, they weren't thinking of it as a nice appreciating asset where, you know, I would convert US dollars into Bitcoin and I would have a nice portfolio. That might be an interesting side effect, but they were using language about changing the world and you know, revolutionizing the world. And one of the ways they were doing that, they said Bitcoin would do that, at least the people who talked to me, was they were thinking, and remember Mises, I don't need to tell you, I'm telling the audience, Ludwig von Mises says that a money is the generally accepted medium of exchange in society. Now, Bitcoin is a medium of exchange. It's not currently the generally most widely accepted one, but it is a medium of exchange. But for it to become, is the goal for Bitcoin ultimately to become money in the Misesian sense, the most widely accepted medium of exchange?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Bitcoin is that it is ultimately an open source project. So nobody can really speak in its name. I can't really pretend to say that this is the goal or this is what Bitcoin does. And by the very same token, the people who, you know, say that you need to be able to buy your coffee with it can't really force others to use it in this way. In other words, you know, open source software is out there on the web. Anybody can use it in whatever form they want. And then if others want to use it in that form, you can't stop them. They keep using it. And so that's how Bitcoin goes. So really the evolution of Bitcoin and how it has evolved is really not something that anyone can decree. It's a product of human action. It's individuals deciding how to use it, how they use it. So yeah, I think initially in the first few years, there was a lot of, and when I first got into Bitcoin, that was my impression that this was going to provide zero fee transactions, you know, instant free transactions all over the world, that you'd have this kind of utopia where, you know, you just flick a button and it's completely secure and money moves from anywhere and it's recorded everywhere. And, you know, soon enough, when you start digging under the hood, you realize Bitcoin has a limit of around 500,000 transactions a day, whereas there are billions of transactions taking place every day. So the notion that we can scale Bitcoin to that level, you know, it can only be done if you increase the size of the blocks enormously. But then if you do that, you can't have it become decentralized. So it ended up evolving in the direction of watching the value of the network grow as the number of transactions was not growing. And this is, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, they criticize my book as if I'm the one implementing this, as if it's, you know, the Bitcoin marketing department putting out press releases on what we plan to do, that we are building a Bitcoin standard that works in this kind of way. But it's really me attempting to study what is actually happening. And what was actually happening is that since 2015 or so, Bitcoin has hit the limit of around 500,000 transactions a day and has remained at that number, roughly, you know, between 300 and 500,000 transactions a day, more or less, since 2015. And so in 6 years, the number of transactions on chain has not grown, but the value of the transactions on chain has grown enormously. So we've done something like 100-fold or whatever, depending on when you calculate it. But it's grown enormously in terms of the value of the transaction. So this is how the network is growing, and it's, you know, it's not my decision to do that. It's the decision of everybody who uses the network in that direction. People are realizing that, you know, spending Bitcoin back and forth involves high transaction costs relatively, and the main liquidity today is still in dollars and in national currencies. So there are transaction costs involved when you're trying to spend the money that is not the most liquid money. On the other hand, you end up missing out on the appreciation. So what's ended up happening is that the people who prioritize just holding on to the coins have ended up with a lot more coins over time. And we're going to this world where people hold the coins rather than use them for daily transactions, at least for now. But, you know, so the question then is, Bitcoin, is it going to change the world by offering the world a cheaper, better PayPal, or is it going to change the world by offering the world a cheaper, better, non-murderous central banking system? I think this is really the question. So if you want to have a better PayPal, you know, Venmo might be it, or whatever Cash App or whatever new app can offer us a better payment user experience. And I think on Bitcoin, that's going to come from the Lightning Network, which is growing and is going to become more and more used as Bitcoin transaction fees rise. And I expect Bitcoin transaction fees to rise a lot over time. So I think we've got bigger fish to fry, in the sense that if Bitcoin continues to grow in the same way it is growing, eventually Bitcoin transactions are going to become the major, more important international settlement transactions. And then we slowly minimize the role of central banks in the real world economy, because more and more of the real world economic activity is going to run on digital Bitcoin settlement. And I think that's really the direction in which Bitcoin is going. And I think, honestly, that's far more significant than, you know, improving payment apps.
What do you think are the prospects for national governments regulating Bitcoin more in one way or another? Every time the price goes up rapidly and everyone is paying attention to it, there's always some article about, well, so-and-so in Germany is very concerned about this and thinks regulators need to look into it. Another thing that I remember being told about Bitcoin early on was that there was the impression that it was almost invincible, that there was nothing you could do to stop it. And in the U.S., at the very least, a roadblock was placed in its way by the IRS rule that basically you have to, if you make a gain on Bitcoin, you have to pay taxes on it, which does, you know, at least in the original version of Bitcoin, is something you were going to be transacting in fairly regularly. That would just cripple you in doing it. I mean, it's, what are the concerns here? Have we reached a point where there's not much they can do, or is there a real danger?
I mean, you know, Bitcoin has been appreciating against the US dollar at 200% a year on average. So if anything they've done has been damaging, it's not really showing much. I think the, you know, again, if you dig more under the hood, you realize that essentially being able to continue to be part of the Bitcoin network is dependent on having a device that can transmit 1 to 2 megabytes, that can receive 1 to 2 megabytes of data in 10 minutes, which doesn't even need a computer device. So ultimately, you know, when you're thinking about the end game of trying to ban Bitcoin, this is where the end game leads at the end, which is that there's really no way that you can just stop people from using satellites and radios and internet devices and all kinds of communication devices to share the blockchain with each other and continue to add blocks every 10 minutes. So it's quite, obviously impossible is a big word, but I think when you look more about the reality of just the kind of attack that would be needed in order to cripple the network in any meaningful sense. And then you compare it, on the other hand, with the incentive for adopting Bitcoin. And I think this is a very important point that people seem to be dismissing, which is ultimately governments are made up of individuals who are self-interested. And I think libertarians appreciate and understand this. And once they come across Bitcoin, it seems to be a recurring theme over the last few years. And it's something that was a bit of a surprise for me, because I personally would have expected a much more aggressive government crackdown on Bitcoin. But instead, what we see is that whenever some government agency comes across Bitcoin, we see the individuals themselves more or less become Bitcoiners and get involved with Bitcoin and even switch careers into Bitcoin. So there are a lot of stories from individuals who in government, you know, were involved in, say, busts of, like, for instance, the Silk Road bust, the investigator that was involved in it. It's quite interesting that they did not choose to, they did not consider the idea that we should just, in fact, she did consider it. She talks about it at some point. She says, you know, that we did think about banning this and closing it down, but then they realized, no, we just use this. We use it to figure out what's going on, and it's just too complicated to ban it. And then she ended up working in Bitcoin, and now she's in the Bitcoin industry. So I think when you start thinking about this as just a more advanced technology, I like to make the analogy with gunpowder, in that when gunpowder came out, you know, gunpowder could destroy armies that used to fight with sticks and stones and swords. With gunpowder, you could destroy an entire army. So what is the smart thing for you to do? Should you ban it so that nobody could use it against your army, or would you use it? Would you get it for your army? I think this is what's more likely, that as individuals and governments and individuals in governments hear about Bitcoin and understand what's really going on, they're drawn to being on the side of Bitcoin. And we're seeing this happen a lot as more and more the regulatory environment is becoming clearer. And, you know, large Wall Street companies can now hold, publicly traded companies can now hold Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Insurance companies are now holding Bitcoin. It's heading in the direction of more and more acceptance. And I think in a sense that it's a little bit of Stockholm syndrome, I think, that people just continue to miss the train because they continue to tell themselves that, no, this is a good thing, so of course government is going to ban it. Well, maybe this thing is too good to ban. Maybe. And I think the kind of the tragedy of the Stockholm syndrome is that, you know, the captives are going to remain in captivity long after the prison keepers have gone after the Bitcoin and left the prison gates open. Essentially, they're going to be disappointed to realize that, you know, the people that they had expected would ban Bitcoin because, you know, they're looking out for the national currency are actually benefiting from Bitcoin, and their mental captives of the state are going to be left behind. Perhaps that's what's going to be happening. We'll see.
I don't know if it was you, but somebody, I think it was you on Twitter, saying something like, look, if our critics are going to sit around ridiculing Bitcoin as opposed to buying some and getting into it, leave them in their ignorance. You know, let's let our people be the ones who prosper. You know, if they want to be the very last ones, let them. I mean, did you say something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great thing because the way the Bitcoin has been going, you know, it alienates the right people. This is another thing. I did a presentation at the Mises Institute on Bitcoin and Austrian economics, and I spoke about all those points that I mentioned earlier. And one of them was that, you know, Bitcoin and Austrians have the same enemies in the sense of, you know, all of these horrible economists like Paul Krugman and so on and Nouriel Roubini, they're obsessed with Bitcoin. And it's amazing to watch them, you know, they studied it enough to pass snarky judgment on it when it was around $100. And here we are about 1,000-fold higher. And they're still out there bitterly shaking their fists and rabidly cursing at people. And it's great because, you know, Bitcoin alienates the right kind of people. Because if you see Bitcoin, you know, immediately, if you believe in the state theory of money, if you think the government has to control money, Bitcoin immediately rubs you the wrong way. And so then you start just getting emotionally attached in Bitcoin denial. And you get emotionally attached in with just needing Bitcoin to fail and having to argue about it and finding more and more reasons why it's going to fail. And you see these people shifting from one narrative to the other. You know, at one time, Bitcoin is both an insignificant Ponzi, but also it's going to be banned by governments, but also it's going to go to zero on the market on its own, but also it's spending too much energy. And it's just a whole bunch of emotional reaction that people get around this thing. While Bitcoin obviously doesn't give a shit, it's just the news. I hope, I'm sorry for the language.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah, Bitcoin just continues to make new blocks every 10 minutes and the supply continues to increase. And then more and more people think about it practically, which is, oh, wow, you know, this thing is less inflationary than all the other alternatives that I have. I should probably get some of it. So, you know, rational, self-interested people are likely to see the good side of Bitcoin. And they're likely, you know, the shift that Bitcoin does to you, I think we see this all the time on Twitter, is that as people get into Bitcoin, I think it's because they are better able to provide for their future. Like they finally discover the idea of saving, which for most people in our generation is just something that has never existed. You don't save money. Like you have to invest money, which is like an extra job. You know, you go and you gamble with the money and it's like an extra job, but you don't have this idea of just, you know, I made this money and now I'm just going to lock it up and it's going to stay there and it doesn't need any more attention. It doesn't need constant supervision and, you know, shifting it from here to the other, from one place to the other. It's saving. And so it's providing people more certainty on the future. It's making the future less uncertain. And I think that's why it's leading to people lowering their time preference. We see this all the time on Twitter, people just discovering Bitcoin and, you know, quitting drinking or quitting drugs and straightening out their lives and starting to save money and stacking sats slowly. And then you see them grow their stash as they start from, you know, working very basic jobs and stacking sats, and then it grows and can be life-changing after a point because it grows so fast.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's an extremely important point you made, because that's a point against fiat money. Like even in before there was a Bitcoin in the 19th century, you could accumulate hard money coins and they would appreciate. They would at least hold their value, but generally they would appreciate. And so you wouldn't think, well, let's see, should I buy into a mutual fund or should I do? I mean, most people don't know what they're supposed to do with that, and nor should they have to. And so that's a great thing about a sound money is that, as you say, it doesn't need to be looked after. You don't need to think, well, if I turn my back for 10 years, this thing's going to lose 15% of its value. That's terrible. No, nobody wants that. And then the other thing you said about us having enemies in common, the Bitcoin people and the Austrian people, It's so strange why it would be exactly the same people who can't wait to see Bitcoin fail, who also can't wait to see Florida have half the population die because they're not following the expert opinion on the virus. It's the same people. And again, the rationale changes. Well, it'll be the college football national championship. That'll do it. Then nothing happened. And then it's, Florida must be fudging their numbers. And we blew that one up. It's always, they can never just say, you know what? Maybe Florida might have gotten it right. Never. That is impossible. And likewise with Bitcoin, they can't ever say, well, maybe this has more staying power than I thought, or maybe there are some merits to this. Can't be, because their worldview is one in which the world needs to be managed by experts. And that includes the money, that includes public health, and anything that undermines that narrative or embarrasses them has to be ridiculed. I think ultimately that's what it is.
That absolutely is the case. It really is very true. And it's a very astute observation because it's at the heart of what Bitcoin gets at. Because not only does Bitcoin take the experts out of money, out of central banks, it takes money out of the places where the experts are. And also, it takes away the mechanism for all the different flavors of stupid expert out there that wants to control you, you know, because all of those people run 100% on fiat. You know, these jobs would not exist on the market. Nobody wants to pay for people to go around locking them at home. On the free market, there would be much better jobs, but all of these people are bureaucrats who are protected from the competition of the free market and who are just getting paychecks from essentially a bottomless pocket, which is facilitated by fiat money. So the common cause here is that, you know, when Bitcoin is done, it's going to severely limit the ability of governments to collect seigniorage and maybe completely eliminate it. And then in a world in which governments have to collect taxes and pay bills like everyone, you know, it's a world in which governments need to start becoming adults. And in that world, I think all kinds of experts would need to find the actual jobs, you know, serving actual human beings rather than just controlling them.
Well, how about that? Well, let's wrap up with this. Of course, your book, The Bitcoin Standard, really needs to be read by everybody. It will help them understand Bitcoin on a much deeper level, and it'll give them some good sound economics as well. But you've also branched out into online instruction. So maybe in our parting moments, you might say a word about that.
Yeah, so on my website, saifeddin.com, I've started an online platform for education on Austrian economics and Bitcoin. I've quit my university job to do this full-time, and I've been doing it now for about, it's been 2 years, I think. Yeah, 2 years. And it's going great. I love it. We've got a weekly seminar, and we have, I've done 4 courses already. So you can sign up and you can take those 4 courses. The material for the course is already online. And then you can join the weekly seminars. We've got 2 live seminars every week where we discuss the courses and we discuss Bitcoin and Austrian economics in general and all kinds of interesting topics. And that's at saifeddin.com. And you can join for $15 a month, starting $15 a month or $100 a year. And you can get a 20% discount for Thomas Woods listeners by just using the code Tom Woods. So use Tom Woods and you'll get the, did I say 20? 20%, right?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Thank you, man.
Yes, all right, absolutely. And there's also, I should mention that also you'll be getting a weekly chapter from my 2 forthcoming books. So I'm sending these out to subscribers on the website. Every week you get a chapter from The Fiat Standard, which is the sequel to The Bitcoin Standard, and The Principles of Economics, which is the textbook, the college level entry textbook that I'm writing on economics in the Austrian tradition. I'm about halfway through both books right now. So sign up and you'll get both books delivered, both chapters getting to you every week. And you'll read all the previous half of the chapters that's already up.
All right, look, first of all, I want to make sure and spell this for everybody. I'll have it on the show notes page. That's tomwoods.com/1870, but it's saifeddan.com. I love the way it looks, by the way. I love you resting your arm on the stack of translations of Bitcoin Standard. That's a beautiful idea. And I also love the fact that you got out of the university system. I mean, not that it's inherently bad to be in it, but that you successfully withdrew, have been on your own, have done something you love, haven't had to deal with bureaucracy or university politics or anything. You just do what you love and you provide a service to people who love what you do. Well, that's putting your money where your mouth is. That is the free market. And yet, even when we're confident that we have an audience and we have something to offer them, there's still something a little bit nerve-wracking about making that move. And yet you did it successfully, and things like that just thrill me. So congratulations to you on that.
Thank you so much, Tom. And it means a lot coming from you, because you were an inspiration for me to do this, looking at your website and what you've been doing. It really helped me make the jump, and I'm very glad I did. So thank you.
Well, I'm just glad to be on the same team with somebody like you. So I'm going to link to your site again at tomwoods.com/1870. Also, your Twitter. People should be following you on Twitter. You're as salty on Twitter as I am. So I just love seeing that side of you out there. Well, thanks so much for your time today. This has been excellent, and I hope people will follow you beyond this episode. Thanks again.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tom. Take care.
All right, everybody. Now, it is possible to go out and use Bitcoin to buy things, and an easy way to do that is through a website created by a listener of this very podcast, and it's spendabit.co. And if you go to spendabit.co, what you find is simply a prompt to search 3 million plus products that you may want to buy, and they'll find you a place to buy these products using Bitcoin. So if that's something you want to do, this is maybe the easiest way to go about doing it. It's the simplest site imaginable. When you see it, you almost won't believe how simple it is. All it is just a prompt waiting for you to type in something you're looking to buy, and then it'll find you a place where you can buy it with Bitcoin. So I'll put that on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1870, spendabit.co. And as it happens, the creator of that site took advantage of my hosting offer. Get your web hosting through my link and you get a great price on the hosting, but I'll also promote your site here on the Tom Woods Show and give you a bunch of other goodies that are really going to give you a nice boost and a special advantage as you get started with your site. So if that's something that interests you, if you're thinking of starting a site, make sure before you do that, you check out tomwoods.com/publicity and you find out about all the bonuses I can give you and all the different ways I can help you. Tomorrow, our old friend John Tamney from Real Clear Markets comes back to the show to talk about the economic side of what's happened over the past year. So don't miss that. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.